Wishes Project was started some time ago at St. Joseph's Hospital in Hamilton in the area of research to see what we could do better to humanize the dying experience in intensive care. It's a highly technical area. It often involves lots of machines, et cetera, and it's easy to lose the person that's involved and turn them into a patient. The Three Wishes aims to dignify the patient, gives voice to the family, and calls forth compassion in the clinicians that are involved. So the overall goal of the Three Wishes Project is to provide individualized care at end of life. It aims to humanize the dying experience and acknowledge personhood in every patient.
This is Dishing Doulas Podcast with Joanne Hahn and Karen Hendrickson of Deaf Doula Network International, changing the world's approach to dying and death one conversation at a time. Seriously, let's talk. Whether you're an end-of-life professional, a family caregiver, or you simply want to gain comfort with end-of-life matters, we're here to help expand your comfort with our shared mortality, end-of-life planning, and the important conversations. The views shared in this podcast are solely those of the hosts and our guests, and are for information purposes only. Be sure to consult with your own healthcare and legal professionals for any personal, medical, or legal advice.
Leslie Buller-Hayes is the founder and owner of Stonehenge Transitions, end-of-life doula services, a compassionate initiative aimed at providing support and guidance to individuals and families navigating all aspects of the often tumultuous journey of end-of-life. She is also a seasoned registered nurse with over three decades of experience, primarily specializing in critical care. Her dedication to patient care and her understanding of the complexities of health in times of critical illness have been the cornerstone of her remarkable career. She is an advocate for redefining societal attitudes towards death and dying, recognizing the importance of education and open dialogue. She actively engages in promoting awareness and understanding surroundings of end-of-life experiences. As a death educator and change agent, Leslie strives to challenge misconceptions and foster a culture of acceptance and empowerment in facing life's most profound inevitability. Leslie is on a mission to transform the narrative surrounding dying and death. Through her multifaceted roles as a healthcare professional, entrepreneur, advocate, learner, and educator, she continues to inspire positive change, leaving an indelible mark on the lives she touches. Welcome, Leslie.
Leslie, you've been an ICU nurse for over 20 years. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up in that profession and how it may have influenced you in the other work you do as well, that being of a death doula?
Joe, almost 20 years in ICU, but 30 years a nurse for sure. I come from a long line of nurses. My mother was a nurse. I have several aunts that was a nurse. And back when nursing was sort of a less than profession, I have great grandparents that were nurses as well. So it seemed sort of somewhat of a natural inclination for me to choose nursing. I basically grew up in a house with chronic illness. So I knew very early on that I was going to do something somewhat in a helping profession. Whether I chose social work was or nursing was sort of up in the air for quite some time because I felt very called to both. But as it turns out, I chose nursing, or perhaps nursing chose me. I still love what I do. And because of my role in the ICU, I was called to do more death work in that of an end-of-life doula. And obviously, well, I don't know if it's obvious to you guys, but most of the people around me, Deaf Doula International has played a great role for me in expanding my role and trying to figure out how nursing and doula work could go together. And initially I struggled with that, but I realize now it can very cohesively go together because there's many aspects to the doula role. I think my biggest passion coming out of ICU into doula work is probably towards the advanced care planning, crucial conversation, changing the narrative around dying and death is I'm most passionate about.
Would it be fair for us to say that passion has come from your experiences within the ICU? And so, you know, I guess that's one question, but we'd also too love for you to, if you feel able, can you illustrate an experience for us with family in ICU that may have informed your passion for the need for these conversations, advanced care planning and preparation?
Sure. I mean, as you know, there's confidentiality clauses, so I could paint a number of stories, but I'll do so in a way in which we don't actually drop any identifiers. Mm-hmm. Okay. Each and every day that I walk through the doors of the ICU, I'm meeting people on the worst days of their lives. If you're meeting me inside the hospital, it is usually one of the worst days of your life. I am meeting people in crisis, in serious illness or in critical illness or at end of life. It's usually happened as a result of something incredibly sudden or unexpected, or perhaps a chronic illness that has taken a big turn for the worse. And this is something that we see day in and day out. There is a multitude of stories that accompany the situations. And I think I'm drawn to the work by and large because with some crucial conversation amongst family members, things could change the trajectory of somebody's experience in the ICU. By that, I mean, we live in a society in which talking about death and serious illness is really somewhat swept under the carpet, as you both know. It's not comfortable, and we avoid things in this society that are generally uncomfortable. So we avoid the topic until we're faced with crises. For the most part, it's not every single family, but I would say probably, I don't have actual statistics to accompany that today, but I would say that well over 75% of our population in the ICU has never had a conversation, doesn't have an advanced care plan in place, doesn't have a power of attorney, or if they have, they haven't actually identified to the person that they are the power of attorney, which causes a whole other gamut of issues.
And so if my person is in the ICU because they've had a traumatic event and we're looking at end of life and we've never had any conversations or done any of the preparation, what does this look like for us? What will this ICU experience look like for us?
Well, initially, your loved one's going to come in and generally be settled by nursing staff, depending on the level of acuity. There's several things that happen. You're going to be supported by a grouping of, well, it is my hope that you're going to be supported by a group of people who are passionate about their work. They're going to bring you in and we're going to hold you in our space and embrace and hopefully help you cope through the dynamics that are ICU. It is a highly mechanical environment. There are a multitude of alarms. There's big glass windows that and big glass doors that are visual in each room. So a lot of times people are kind of overwhelmed even by the time they get to their loved one's room because they've peeked in as they've walked by other rooms. And because of the highly mechanical environment and the level of acuity that's present and incredibly obvious, the level of overwhelm is usually very apparent. We, as we wrap you in our blanket of support, which sometimes just means like, we're here for you. Words of support, I recognize that this is a highly emotive time for you. I understand you're in crisis. I understand you're stressed. I know those things come from a place of love. But we oftentimes can get lost also. It's a very task-oriented, task-heavy environment. And in order to stabilize and keep people alive, we are very caught up in the tasks rather than the family support. It is very much a part of it. There's no doubt, but it's not hard to get lost in the tasking. And then there's all kinds of, as the patient settles in, whether they're there for an extremely short period of time or could be there for a long period of time. We've had patients with us in the ICU for as long as 2 years. And in that case, you get to know people incredibly well, but in the short, acute, serious crises phase, oftentimes we're left just picking up bits and pieces of what this person is about by their family members.
And so if my family member's there's been a traumatic event, ICU really is just prolonging life with no sustainable quality. My person doesn't have any medical representative or medical proxy or POA, depending on where what you call it, wherever you're located. And no work or conversations have been done. What happens for my person?
So depending on trajectory or outlook, sometimes we continue with life support until either the person declares themselves. And when I say that statement, a lot of people might not understand, but if you are critically ill to the point that we are doing everything we can, and that's still not enough, people will, what we call, declare themselves, meaning they will die despite all of our efforts. In a situation in which there is no advance directive, there's no, that word actually doesn't come up very often in intensive care, but advanced care plan or power of attorney to make decisions for the person, if none of those exist, then depending on where we are, it could be a short period of time, 15 minutes into a stay, or it could be a couple of hours later. There's generally a conversation that takes place where the key players in care are, as well as family, obviously, are in a meeting. If the person can participate, the patient, they are often involved, but at the very beginning and its heavy critical period, often the patient is sedated and intubated and therefore not able to participate in conversations. Reality-based conversations can be difficult in the ICU. It can be very difficult for doctors to bring up a conversation in which we present medical futility. It can be very difficult in saying that. It can be very difficult for nurses as well. But when there's no power of attorney and there's no decision maker, the family either appoints one, or Ontario has a hierarchy of decision making, substitute decision makers. We would refer to that, and that person would be appointed and they would be, I'm going to say, saddled with the decision making for that patient. Lots of families feel that it's a burden and they don't want to make decisions. They don't want to be the one to say, enough's enough, or my loved one would never want to live this way. They don't want to have to carry that in their grief process. So we often involve social work. Social work is a phenomenal resource for us in intensive care, but oftentimes things happen after hours. We don't have a social work after hours, and we don't have a social worker on weekends. So oftentimes I shouldn't say that, there's a social worker on call, but if she's overburdened, which they often are, and I say she, there are he's too, but if they're overburdened and they can't make it, then they can't make it. And so one of two things happens. The family member that's appointed makes decisions, but more often than not, it is the person who is in critical illness is on life support, and they stay that way, often leading to prolonged suffering in a highly mechanized environment where they have an inability to communicate. But they're also almost always in a state of sedation, so they wouldn't necessarily be cognizant of their situation.
Leslie, Jennifer O'Brien, the hospice doctor's widow, talks about her husband, Bob, and how he used the term precious time with his patients. So can you tell us how this phrase has impacted you in the ICU and how you've become even more instrumental in helping ICU docs and other nurses to understand and appreciate the importance of understanding precious time and being frank with families about that?
I love the term precious time. It is near and dear. I use it with some amount of regularity. The first time I heard that term, I was actually a guest on Blueberry Road. Helen Grimalowski had a campfire chat that I was a part of, and Jennifer O'Brien was being interviewed. And she brought up the concept of Bob's, her husband's, precious time in his hospice practice. And I was just so taken. It's such a succinct way of saying to somebody, this is it. This is the time at which you need to leave no loving words unsaid. You need to be at your family member's bedside. You need to gather your family. You need to come. This is precious time. I have used it in a number of situations. I've used it with the docs in saying, has anybody called the family? we have a critical event happening. Perhaps there's a code blue. Perhaps we've got after a code blue, which means return of spontaneous circulation. And I will say, has anybody called family? And there's sometimes there's a little bit of pushback because there's more things to do. Perhaps we don't have to call. Maybe this is just a blip in care. I feel it's always very important when in any change in care or in anything untoward happens that we reach out to family and give them the opportunity to be with their loved one at end of life. It is imperative to me. So I will say to the docs, this is precious time. We need to allow the family to know that this is precious time. And I had one young doc say to me, it's Dr. Matt Jeffkins, and I'm certain he wouldn't mind me using his name today because he's a wonderful clinician in Northern Ontario. And he said to me, oh, I like that. That's very, that works. And I said, oh, I would love to take credit for that statement, but it's so not mine. It's Jennifer O'Brien's. And I explained the situation about her husband being a hospice doctor. And he said, do you think that I could use that? And I said, well, I know you can. I know nothing would bring Jennifer greater joy than for people to spread that word and use it. I feel like it crosses all boundaries. It doesn't matter the socioeconomics, the education, the psychosocial dynamic. It is brief, it is succinct, and it gets a point across like many other statements or phrases cannot.
It's kind, loving.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And when you put your hand upon the family member's shoulder of their person who is dying and you say, this is your precious time, they know. It's, I don't know how they, but I've never yet experienced anybody say, I don't understand what you mean. Never yet had anybody say, you know, what are you talking about? It conveys the idea that end of life is near like nothing I've ever experienced before.
It's a beautiful phrase.
It is.
In those moments when you have utilized that phrase with family members, what do you see happen next?
Depending on the family dynamic, a couple of things can happen. It can bring almost a little bit of a like a flutter of activity, for a lack of better words, where it's kind of like this coming of the hearts of the family come together. It's like a coming together of the minds, the hearts, the family comes together and they're like, okay, she just said that this is precious time. We need to have whoever reach out to the family that's not there. We need to have, it's almost like there's a small delegation that happens within the family dynamic. You almost immediately have people come right to the bedside, or you could have people who go into a room and make a few phone calls, but it's like a gathering of resources. And then the family will come to the bedside and it's beautiful. Warm things are said. And the things that people say to their loved ones at end of life always amaze me. It's just a privilege to be witness to. As I said earlier, the words precious time is like somehow there's this invisible thread that pulls all of the hearts in the family together. And it doesn't seem to matter if there's been estrangement or has if there's been like a difficult dynamic. It pulls the people together in the room and they come and they support their loved ones.
It's a lot gentler than having somebody say, it's time to call the rest of the family together.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I remember that was our experience when my son was in the ICU and the doc said, yeah, it's time to call your husband. And you know, right? Precious time would have been a lot gentler. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What a great phrase that is.
Mm-hmm. I think it has the potential to change. Well, I'm certain it has changed a multitude of lives.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. So what do families in the ICU need to do better?
That's an interesting question because I feel very strongly that I'm not sure they need to do anything better, but I think we have a whole lot of stuff to do better for them. I think that just sitting down with your loved ones and having the conversation about serious illness, about what things might look like for you at end of life. I think people seem to forget, because we're a society in which we don't talk about end of life, we don't talk about serious illness, people forget that in these situations, somebody else is going to be making their decisions for them. And so if you don't have paperwork in order, similarly to the question that Karen asked earlier, you know, what happens when? Well, let's just look at for a moment the difficult relationships, which many people who will be listening will understand. Let's say you are a separated woman. I mean, you don't have a good relationship with your separated partner, but you're not divorced. That person is the person who's going to be making your decisions for you. If you have not got your paperwork in order, it is your ex-partner, your ex-spouse, if you're not divorced, that's going to make those decisions for you. So all of a sudden, you've got all this dynamic. There could be a new partner in the picture, but that partner just doesn't have any legs to stand on whatsoever. It becomes the word of whoever's making the substitute decisions in that situation. Most recently, I had a situation in which this very elderly patient of ours had all of her ducks in a row. Like, her advanced care plans were done. Her power of attorney was done. Sadly, she was admitted over a weekend, and she had chose to put all of her paperwork very securely with her lawyer. We had no access to that paperwork at all. And so legally speaking, we have to do everything until we have the paperwork. So for the duration of the weekend, she has to be a full code because she had no family members and her paperwork was inaccessible. So putting your paperwork with a lawyer or with somebody who's not accessible or in a safety deposit box, that's certainly something that has come up in the past, where then that person doesn't have a key and you're not able to speak for yourself and say, oh yes, provide this person with a key. That person is my power of attorney. If they have no documentation to support the fact that they are the power of attorney, and not just for personal care, but for personal property, because in order to get into a safety deposit box, you would need to have the power of attorney for finances in this province anyway. So your paperwork, if you do have it, it must be accessible. And that's just, that's almost semantics, but it's imperative. We have to understand that paperwork is not only important, but paperwork must be accessible. And let's go back to complicated relationships for a few minutes. And there's people in my own personal life who would understand this. You know, you have a young person, let's say they're in their 30s, independent, estranged from both parents. If they were to experience a critical illness or a serious illness, landing themselves in the ICU, one of their parents would be making the decisions for them, even though they haven't spoken more than 10 years. They don't even know who you are as a person, let alone what you would want at end of life. You haven't discussed anything. There hasn't been any type of conversation in years. So how would you possibly make a decision in keeping with that person's wishes and values? You know, what are their priorities? You have no idea. You've never had a conversation in a multitude of time. So these are the things that the patients and families in ICU need to do better, for sure, is stop being afraid to have the conversation. Get your priorities in order. Look at your values. It's difficult, but my death is more certain than my next birthday. So when we look at things that way, we need to get our paperwork in order.
Can you say that again? My death.
My death is more certain than my next birthday. And you know, that's a hard statement to make. But when we think about that, it's the absolute 100% honest to God truth.
Yeah.
Just do your loved ones a favor and sit down with them. Honestly, it's a gift, and it's the greatest gift I believe that we can give our loved ones, so that if we're faced with critical illness, we don't have to carry the burden because we already know what it is that our loved one would want.
Yeah, it becomes a loving act to make the decisions in support of our person versus making the decision that we really have no clue what they wanted and then carrying that uncertainty. So you've recently been involved in the Three Wishes Project within your ICU. Can you tell us what this is all about?
Sure. It's an honor and a privilege to be involved, actually. So the Three Wishes Project was started some time ago. It was started actually at St. Joseph's Hospital in Hamilton. I'll just give you a little tiny bit of a background. It was started in the area of a research to see what we could do better to humanize the dying experience in intensive care. It's a highly technical area. It often involves lots of machines, et cetera, and it's easy to lose the person that's involved and turn them into a patient. The Three Wishes aims to dignify the patient, gives voice to the family, and calls forth compassion in the clinicians that are involved. So the overall goal of the Three Wishes Project is to provide individualized care at end of life. It aims to humanize the dying experience and acknowledge personhood in every patient. So if we're certain that a patient is going to die, which oftentimes we're pretty certain at an early period of time, or let's say a patient's been with us for a period of time and it becomes evident that they are not going to get well, but they're going to die, you approach the family, giving them much regard for their current situation, and see if you can't get to know their person, the patient, a little bit more, what their values and priorities are, and then we introduce the Three Wishes Project. If your loved one had a wish in their dying process, what would it be? And these are simple wishes. They're not complicated. We're not looking to give anybody a trip to Florida. It's more like comfort-based. Does your loved one have a favorite blanket? Did they like favorite color? Things that we can introduce at the bedside to humanize the environment as well as humanize the patient. It helps a great deal. We also provide small, what I would call like memorandums or like a memory gift, where when a family consents, we will take fingerprints from the patient and put them into a small keychain. And then the keychains are distributed to the family members. And we can do as many as are required. It's just a small, I don't like the word token, but it's a small gift to give the family so they leave with something tangible of their family members. And we will often print an ECG strip of their beating heart and roll that and put it into a tiny glass vial tied with a ribbon. And we distribute those to family members as well if they so choose. And those small gifts that give the patient personhood bring so much comfort to the family that it is absolutely incredible. Just very recently, I was involved in a situation where we introduced the Three Wishes Project, and the family members were a little bit taken aback and like, wow, there wasn't the timeline involved to be able to like really look at autonomy and what the patient would like. The patient was in a situation in which they were no longer cognizant, but that doesn't decrease the grieving that the family is going through at that period of time. And it's a situation in where these small gifts can say to the family, your person mattered. Not only to you, but to us as clinicians. And in recognizing that that person mattered to you, we will distribute a sympathy card amongst all of our staff and have people sign. And that lights people up in the intensive care as well. And when I say people, I mean everyone from portering to housekeeping staff to nursing to physicians to social work to everybody who's involved in this great big healthcare family that is looking after your loved one. And just handing the card over is, you know, I've had a couple of people say to me, well, I don't feel comfortable in signing the card. I didn't know that person. I said, oh, it's not about knowing the person or knowing the family. It means your family member mattered. They mattered not only to you, but they mattered to us too. We've taken the time to put together this small gift for you. It's presented in a small brown bag that's got a butterfly on the outside of it. It says, courtesy of the Three Wishes Project. Inside that bag, you will find the keychains that are tied together with a ribbon and the fingerprints of the loved one. You'll find the vials with the ECG strips. There's often a card. There can be a multitude of different things that's offered, but that's what's been most common. I mean, this project, we trialed it in September to January, but it just rolled out formally in January. For the family, it creates sort of enduring positive memories of a horrible situation, generally. It allows them to leave with something tangible of their family member. It helps to counter the visual, the auditory, the often tactile overstimulation of an ICU environment and bring it back to humanity.
I think oftentimes we forget that the medical team are people and that they care about the patient. When you get a gift like that from your team, it's heartwarming.
It Absolutely.
Would be heartwarming, yeah.
And we do care. We care a great deal, and we are often witness to some pretty atrocious things, which creates a lot of compassion fatigue and caregiver fatigue. And this, I will tell you, this is something that offers some relief. It offers hope and it offers relief, and people feel really good when they provide a family with these sort of a change in the overall dynamic that we often bring to the table.
So it's almost like ritual, right?
Absolutely.
It's almost like a ritual that for the family really lets the family know that the care team, the medical team are saying, we saw your person and you're not just walking out of here being completely forgotten. We saw you. And so for the family, I can only imagine what that must do in changing how some of that might feel. And then for all of you as a care team, it helps with the grief that you carry with every human you're witness to dying. It's got to.
It absolutely does. It helps, I think, with the grieving process. It helps to acknowledge the grieving process of the family immediately. I mean, let's face it, the grief doesn't begin after their person dies. Mm-hmm. The grief begins the moment they land in the ICU. Mm-hmm. Grief, as we know, doesn't have to belong to the bereaved. It belongs to many people, and it certainly belongs to those whose family members are in the ICU. And then when you're told or you receive the horrific news that your loved one's going to die, this gives you a step into the grieving process, something that you can hang on to. We were recently told that one of these keychains was given to a 5-year-old grandson of one of our patients, and he sleeps with it every night. He loops the ring that you would normally put on your keys around his thumb, and he sleeps with it in his palm of his hand every night. That feels great.
Yeah. But imagine what it must be doing for you as medical staff, as the professionals that have been caring for these people, because grief belongs to family, but grief lives in healthcare professionals too.
Oh, it certainly does. And it's not often that it's acknowledged. And I think that's part of this project that is also an honor to be a part of, because it does acknowledge the fact that healthcare workers, we have big hearts. It's why we do what we do. And we carry the griefs. I had a young nurse come to me just the other day and said, I cried in front of family tonight. And I said to her, well, that's okay. And she said, well, I usually can keep it together better than that. And I said, you're human. It's allowed. We're allowed to cry. I said, you know, certainly you regain composure if you feel like you are going to be uncontrollably sobbing, because that's not a place of support. But we are human and we watch people grieve, which is probably harder than looking after the patient themselves. I'm usually fine looking after the patient and meeting their needs, because I feel that it's a great honor to provide somebody with excellent end-of-life care. But it's hard. It's hard to watch a grieving family. When you bring a mother into the room of a child and you watch them completely melt at a bedside, it's incredibly hard to keep it together. Incredibly hard. And to me, if you don't have some tears, I mean, I kind of feel like we're people. We should have some tears. I'm not robotic. And if I'm expected to be robotic, then our profession needs to change because I can't be. I think it also shows family when I have a tear rolling down my cheek that I wipe away, it shows families that I am human and I care and I see you and I see your grief.
A friend of mine's mom died and she was given the EKG and she turned that into a tattoo.
Awesome.
Right. It was incredible. It was the first time I'd seen that done, but what a great way to remember and to honor her mother. That was. Hmm.
We are told that often the fingerprints that we provide are often used to make tattoos with as well, more memorial tattoos. Hmm. And in addition, the Three Wishes Project, not only does it do the things we've already talked about, it promotes interprofessional relationships. So it's like a coming together of this healthcare team. Like I said, environmental services involved, ordering's involved, nursing's involved, physicians are involved, everybody is involved. So it brings together teams. It exemplifies humanism in practice. It brings us back to our humanity.
We can see in this conversation of your sharing, actually the emotional impact that it has for you alone. This is valuable.
Absolutely.
For you can see it, right? Yeah. And I think anybody that ever ends up with a person in the ICU would be wanting to have people like you caring for them.
Makes a tremendous difference. When my son was in the ICU after he passed, I went downstairs and the team from Children's Hospital that came in, we're sitting in the lobby with tears, apologizing that they couldn't save him. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my goodness, it never occurred to me the impact that this whole experience had on the team. But it humanized it too.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we are people who go home to families. Interestingly enough, my daughter used to say to me, oh, you looked after somebody my age today. Because I just hug her a little bit tighter. And things like that happen routinely. Same as you look after somebody the same age as yourself. And that makes you go, whew, okay, I have much to be grateful for today. There are so many experiences that we have as healthcare providers take you back to the humanity of just being vulnerable. We need to show each other that we care. We aren't robotic. I'm still incredibly passionate about nursing. There are hard things about working in healthcare these days, but I love what I do and I'm lucky. And I know that I'm lucky that I love what I do.
I think there's a whole bigger conversation here, but I'm glad we're touching on it today. And that is what I feel is sort of happening right here is through this conversation is you've called us and anybody that listens to stop for a moment and remember that those healthcare professionals that are out there every day helping to keep our people alive or helping to keep our people comfortable, whatever it may be, are human beings and they carry compassion fatigue and grief and probably that element of things we forget and we need to stop and acknowledge that.
But you know, it's evident that a lot of the healthcare professionals are still uncomfortable with the death conversations. So, Leslie, what would you offer them as guidance to be able to step through the discomfort and have those conversations anyways?
Well, that's a big question. But instantly, I think what I can offer myself is just the knowledge that the first time you have the conversation, it's going to be hard. You're going to get red in the face. You're going to get overheated. Your knees are going to feel wobbly. Just about any conversation that's really difficult like this one is going to bring those sort of feelings. But you do it because you're passionate about doing it. And then the next conversation comes just a slightly bit easier. And so on and so on and so on. But I think at a much bigger, grander scale than I could possibly offer myself, we need to introduce with regularity the curriculum on how to speak about difficult things with family. We need to have realistic, robust, transparent, reality-based conversations with families about end of life, the trajectory of care. I mean, in reality, Joe, Karen, we can keep anyone alive these days. For the most part, we really can. And the trajectory of that can be months. The question is, should we keep that patient alive? Does that family really know what they will be facing in the future? Yes, I understand that families need time to come to grips with the picture that they're faced with. I mean, very difficult to accept, let's say your young son in his 20s has done something, made a crazy decision and has landed him in an ICU, and he's got a life-altering brain injury. But does that family know, yes, we can keep your son alive? Does that family know that it's going to mean long-term care for the rest of his days? That he will never have another meaningful conversation? That he will never stand? That he will never turn over? That he will never scratch his own itch? And I understand that people need to come to terms of that. But I think in the beginning, when we say, oh, yes, we've got this, it gives people hope. And I'm not suggesting that we ever take people's hope away, ever. But you can change hope. You can change hope from a life that looks like, yes, we can save them, to how comfortable can we make this person as they're dying? We can change hope. We can change what hope looks like in a picture. Hope just isn't for the living. Hope can be for the dying. You just need to look at it a little bit differently. And I think that that's imperative, that physicians, the healthcare, medical people, medical schools need to introduce dying and death into curriculums, end of life conversations. There needs to be simulations of how do I approach this? You need to be taught how to be silent. When a family member is sitting at a bedside and they're letting their heart pour out, you need to learn to not interrupt. You need to just sit in that uncomfortable silence and allow them to make appropriate decisions for their loved ones. But in order to make appropriate decisions for their loved ones, they have to be given honest, transparent information. Not the information that they're looking for, because that's not going to give them truth. And truth hurts often. It's ugly, it's unbearable, it's grief-filled, it's uncomfortable, and it's horrific. But I know that if my loved one's there at the end of life, I want the honest to God straight up goods. I don't want to be given this painted a picture filled with hope when they're really, the hope is not for life. The hope is for comfortable death.
And I'm going to suggest too that that discussion be in very simple terms, not complicated, so that people can absorb it. So I hate to bring it back to my experience, but when the nurse came in, she said, we can keep your son alive, but he will never be the same again. Pretty succinct. And that gave me the ability to make a decision. Had she gone into technical terms, I wouldn't have absorbed it. So keep it simple.
Absolutely. In my experience, we have many physicians, especially younger ones that are coming out of school. I am seeing hope in our medical staff in which they are willing to have difficult conversations. And that's not necessarily always welcome either, but they're willing to have honest conversations and give realistic outcomes. But we need to do better. And you're right. Speaking in simple terms, in plain language, in which everybody can understand, is imperative. It changes the trajectory of lives. That's why precious time, I think, is such something that I love so much. It's because it is succinct. It conveys a message. And I think we have wonderful practitioners in both nursing and in physicians that can deliver news to families in such a way that we can offer comfort while providing realistic terms of outcome for patients. And I think it's certainly not easy, but it also doesn't have to be as hard as we make it. These crucial conversations need to start in homes but they need to start in schools as well. If we started changing the narrative around death and dying, we would speak much more openly about it. And this would come easier for us as a society. You know, when we farmed out our death care to funeral homes, when our dying stopped dying at home and they started dying in hospital and we started farming out our dead to, we lost something of humanity. That's my personal opinion. I believe that, and I'm not saying that people who are involved in the funeral industry are not okay, because that's not at all what I'm saying. I am saying that we lost pieces of our humanity and our families and our kinship, in which we lost our ability to cope with the dying. And I just used air quotes and I realize that you can't see them, but you know, death and dying, or dying and death, was a very realistic part of our lives in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Very, very much. Children were taught. It's your grandmother in that room. You can go in and sit with them. People had sick rooms in their house. We laid out our dead in our dining rooms. This is something that I think we need to get back to. And then we can get back to having crucial conversations about end of life. It doesn't have to be something extraneous of our households. It can be mainstream, intrinsic to our family structures.
It can all be so integrated, so integrated. And let's give credit due to medical advancement and all of the things that it's brought to the world and the extension of life, but it has created a disconnect from our emotional attachment and closeness with our people in illness and dying, for sure. Absolutely, for sure. And there are some medical professionals out there that are really good at these conversations, but we still see and hear of so many stories where the forthright information comes at the 11th hour. And now all of a sudden, I thought my mom was okay, and now she's dying and she's going to be dead in like 3 days. And what do I do now? Because now I've had no emotional time to even prepare for that. And so if we can change, if through this conversation today, we have the opportunity of changing one experience for one family, you'll have made a difference in sharing your story.
Mm, I love that idea, actually.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. We need to be more open about it. My grandson's 4 years old. His other grandmother died with cancer a few years ago. And my son's father-in-law's here. So Ben, the grandson, said something about granny died by cancer. I could see in his face he didn't know what to say. And so I stepped in and I said, mom and dad have been very open about granny dying and cancer, and just answer his questions. So to a four-year-old, it was just the natural thing. And he talks about death quite a bit. To grandpa, who's in his upper 60s, he didn't know how to respond. So you can see the difference in the generations on people our age, my age, that were a little bit death phobic, where the youngsters are just, it's part of life. So like you say, if we can start when they're young or in school, talking about how dying and death is natural, it's going to make it a lot easier for everybody.
Absolutely. It's not only natural, it is certain. It is certain. I think that's the part that I struggle with, is that we are a society that plans everything, everything, weddings, dinner parties. I mean, we now even have, and you guys have heard me say this before, we now even have gender reveal parties, but people don't plan for their own death. You know, how about you just look at it and like, if I had the opportunity to plan, and I mean, we often don't. I see every day I go to work how people don't have the opportunity to plan. But if you could plan, what would it look like? As simple as, would I want to smell lavender? No, that's terrible. I want to smell sunshine. Or would I want a blue blanket? Or would I want a fuzzy blanket? Or would I want nothing? I'm a simple person. I don't need anything of that nature. I once had a woman, I said to her, oh, but if we could plan it, what would you want? And she said, oh, Leslie, I'm a simple person. I don't need anything. And I said, okay, but we all have needs. And she said, no, what I need from you is you're going to need to support my husband. If this gets past 10 days, you're going to need to support him in making decisions for me. But the more we talked, it became apparent that she had thought about it, because she said, I want to be cremated. And I said, okay, I'll tell your husband. And she said, oh, I wrote him a letter. It's okay. He'll know. But she said, you're going to have to help him. And I said, okay, that's not a problem. She said, and I want my ashes scattered off of my son's dock. And I said, oh, that sounds beautiful. She said, but not too close. The dogs pee there. So she had thought about it. And that was funny. Like, it brought a funny moment. That's the other thing, is it doesn't have to be all serious and dreadful. It can be warm, and it can be human, and it can be kind and filled with joyful moments for not only the patient, but for the family too. And I will go back to what Elaine says from Dying Matters. She says, how people die matters, not necessarily to the patient who's dying, but to those they leave behind. And it's so incredibly true.
Absolutely. We remember how people die.
Absolutely, we do. Yeah. We carry that memory.
So, two final things. Lastly, you know, when we end our conversation today, what are the two most important things you want our listeners to take away from all that you've shared?
I think the first one would be, which I probably am now at the point of nagging or maybe even harping, but get your paperwork in order. Have a conversation with your family. It doesn't matter to me that you're 22 and you don't have anything. Just talk to your parents, talk to your loved ones. Talk to somebody who's willing to listen and support you. Get your paperwork in order. Make sure your paperwork is accessible. Know that your paperwork, your power of attorney, doesn't have to be held by your partner or your parents or your sister or your brother. It could be a friend. It is whoever will best advocate for what you want in your ending. And people are worried. You know, I had a conversation with a girl at work the other day who said, oh, it's my parents. And I said, your parents are old. They're certainly going to die before you, chances are. And she said, well, I don't want to offend anybody. And I said, this is not about offending people. This is about who best represents your values, your priorities at end of life. And you will notice that I don't talk a lot about advanced care planning per se, and more about power of attorney. And that's because in the environment that I work in, advanced care planning, the advanced care plans and the paper they're written on don't have a whole lot of value legally speaking, and your family members can trump them. So I will say, take it further, have an advanced care plan. They're important. They express wishes and priorities. That's very important, but have a power of attorney and have your substitute decision maker and have a conversation. It is imperative that they know they are your substitute decision maker. When we make a phone call and say, so-and-so is here in this environment, you are their substitution decision maker. And they say, I am. That is not going to be conducive to your end of life plan. If they don't even know that you've elected them to be that person, how are they going to carry out your wishes? And honestly, you can't make this stuff up, but I swear it's happened over and over and over. We recently had a person in the ICU. Their power of attorney was somebody she had met on a park bench in a park 6 weeks before. He knew nothing about it.
Wow.
This is the reality of the situation. So people, if you take away anything from my conversation today, see a lawyer. You don't even have to see a lawyer. You could print the paperwork off the internet. Provincially, your government will have provincial papers because each province is different. Print the papers off, take it to a notary public, have it notarized, have a conversation with your loved ones so they know what you want. And the second one would be to not be scared to seek out help if you're having difficulty navigating your healthcare system. And that's not necessarily from an end of life perspective. That's at any portion perspective. If you're having difficulty and you are facing life-limiting illness, or your loved ones are facing life-limiting illness, and you're having difficulty getting the answers you need, seek out a professional, whether that's an end-of-life doula, whether that's an advocate, whether that's a formal patient advocate, whether that's a healthcare system navigator, seek out some assistance, and they will be able to offer you the support in answering your questions. If you are too shy to sit across from the doctor and ask the questions that are going to get you the answers you need, or you're not able, maybe you're not shy and you're not able to get the questions that you're looking, the answers to the questions you're looking for, those people will come across professionally as navigators of a system that is currently suffering. And of course, the people who are working within it, as well as the people who are accessing it, are having difficulty because our system is currently broken. And that's not a secret. That's a federal, across the board, interprovincial problem that we are all facing together. And I strongly urge you, I know of people who spend hundreds of dollars per month on hair and nails and a florist for a specialty bouquet. If those services are worth it to you, then putting somebody in your employ or employing somebody who will go to bat for you and your loved one, maybe your situation is your loved one's going into long-term care and you're not sure the long-term care facility can meet your needs or can meet your loved one's needs. Hire somebody who will help you with that. Don't be afraid of the money that they're asking for, because I know they will be worth it.
Thank you so much, Leslie, for sharing your experiences and your knowledge and your wisdom with us today. And most importantly, your passion for helping to change the world's approach to dying and death, one conversation at a time. We know that you do work still as an ICU nurse, but we also know that you are a doula and you help support individuals through illness and dying and advanced care planning. And people can also reach out to you for patient advocacy. And where can they find you?
Well, thank you so much for having me today. And you can connect with me on several platforms. You can connect with me, first off, through the Death Doula International. I'm part of their membership network. You can find me on all of the socials. You can find me on DDON, which is the Death Doula Network Ontario as well. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on my website, which is www.stonehedgetransitions.ca, which is my business name. And I welcome a connection of any kind. I'm called to this work in a way that I can't explain. But as you've heard, I'm passionate and I have knowledge and skill to bring, and I know I can help.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you.
Catch the next episode of Dishing Doulas podcast and more at www.ddnint.com. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. You can send any questions or comments to admin@ddnint.com and connect with us at Death Doula Network International on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you for listening to the Dishing Doulas podcast, where we're changing the world's approach to dying and death one conversation at a time.